Well, welcome back to Downtown. We are really excited to have a man who's become a regular here on the show, Colin Fleming, and be talking about Thelonious Monk, who would have been 100 years old today were he still with us. Colin, welcome back to Downtown.
Hey, how's it going, Bruce?
It's going well, sir. I was really excited when Rich told me that I would get a chance to talk to you about this. Big Monk fan. Introduced to me by Chris Brubeck, Dave Brubeck's son, who I went to junior high school with, who said to me, I know you like my dad's piano playing, but you got to check out this guy. He does some neat stuff.
I can understand sort of the parallel there, because you have two very melodic pianists, right? We think of Brubeck as maybe more mainstream, but he also has weird time signatures, just like Monk. So we don't tend to think there's much overlap between the two of them, but I can see a comparison there.
Yeah, and a lot of what Chris pointed out to me was a lot of improvising over those really neat, syncopated, funny, differently structured chords, because Monk had such huge hands.
I think Monk actually got a lot of his early style from Count Basie. We don't usually think of Count Basie as like this extraordinary pianist. We think of him as an amazing band leader. But that was kind of the swing that I feel that Monk had. He listened to Art Tatum a lot, and you would never associate Monk with Tatum, because Monk was kind of a chord man, whereas Tatum was all sorts of crazy runs and glissandos and finger-breaking virtuosity. But I think from out of that swing tradition, and then coupled with bebop and slowing bebop down, it allowed Monk to work spaces inside of his music, to write from within spaces, almost like Ahmad Jamal later would, in ways that other composers didn't even think.
Well, one of the things you also pointed out in some of the things I've read that you've written is that Monk may be sort of overlooked sometimes because he wasn't a prolific songwriter. I mean, he's credited with some 70 or 80 songs. I don't remember exactly what the number is. But when you think about his innovation and his style and his incredibly complex compositions, which people often thought were improvising, maybe he really deserves to be right up there at number one.
I think so. You'd be hard-pressed to dislodge Duke Ellington. Ellington was every bit the innovator while having however many songs Duke Ellington had, right? I don't know if you could be much more prolific. So Monk was kind of like a Vermeer, right? He had that 70-odd songs. And what's strange, too, about his songs is they're strange.
Yes.
And yet they're standards. They're almost like Gershwinian, right? Because they kind of shouldn't be standards. They're so atypical. And a standard usually is not quarterly atypical like Monk's were. And they're so complicated, too, harmonically, that if you listen to, like, Blue Monk, it is as tuneful as All You Need Is Love, as a Schubert later. It's, like, as tuneful as you can get. So, yes, he's packing a lot in harmonically, rhythmically, in terms of dissonance, but you can walk down the street literally whistling his composition, which is a neat little trick to pull off.
Well, yeah, and the other thing I think is interesting is his relationship with so many of the great sax players. And you know, I mean, he's Bud Powell and John Coltrane and Bird and all these other guys. Do you think there was something that he heard in the sax that he brought to the piano?
Yes, and I think vice versa. Those tenor players heard something in the way he approached the piano. He must have been like manna for a man like John Coltrane. He's playing in Miles Davis's first grade quintet, and you just talk about like a band that could blow any other off the stage. I mean, that's one of the great small units in all of jazz history. But Coltrane starts to get bored. It's sort of like a glorified, highly impressive, but still at its root version of hard bop.
One of the songs you talk about is Monk's Mood. Carrie, can you punch up just a little bit of that so we can let the listeners get a feel for this? And as you point out, Colin, Monk is best heard live. His live recordings are the tops. Even in that short snippet, as you mentioned, you can hear what a chord guy he was. A lot of chords underneath that melody.
It's very ambulatory, too. It sounds like the composer slash player is walking along with you through this piece of music, maybe taking a sidestep here, a step back here, and then ultimately moving forward again. And I think it was that knack for creating that kind of space within sound that someone like Coltrane really needed to hear. And they were phenomenal together. And Coltrane and Monk recorded at Carnegie Hall in 1957. And I think by any metric, that's one of your five or six best live jazz recordings ever. And Monk made a lot of live recordings after that going forward.
Am I wrong to just think, I mean, I'm not an expert on this by any stretch, but it seems to me that he made more live recordings than most piano players of his generation. Do you think that was because he was so enamored with live playing?
I think it was a combination of things, really. He was what was called at the time quite eccentric.
Yeah.
And now we have evidence that maybe there were some other things going on with him mentally. And I don't know that he was able to sort of work through the rigors of composition after a certain point. But I also think that's a little bit misleading because in concert, Monk was constantly writing and rewriting those pieces and rejiggering them. And he was someone who wrote, I think, more than even most jazz musicians through listening. I think that was another thing he helped Coltrane with. But it was kind of that external stimuli gave him internal revelations on how to approach his own material. So it's not shopworn. When you hear him taking a different version of one of his songs, it's like an entirely new composition, and maybe he just hangs it on those old chords. So even that was pretty innovative. But yeah, it's a lot of live albums. Now, if you go through anyone's discography from that era, jazz is wonderful because we can get the entire week-long residency of somebody. And we don't get that with, like, rock and roll.
Right.
You might get, like, Live at Leeds by The Who. You get one night. And I think Monk's live output stands out so much because he was so infrequently in the studio for a long time.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown, and we're talking about what would have been the 100th birthday of the great jazz pioneer Thelonious Monk, often associated as being a bebop guy, but I've always thought he sort of transcended all kinds of bop. Am I wrong about that? Or
no, I think you're quite correct. And it's weird because he was sort of the first jazz musician I got into when I was in my mid-teens, and I had first heard Charlie Parker. And Parker was going so fast. That was bebop. It was like he was almost lapping himself, and I wasn't quite ready to hear that. So when I'm reading about Monk and he's so tuneful and it's slowed down, I'm thinking, wait, this is bebop too? This doesn't sound like what Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie are doing. But it was like he took those same rhythmic contours and he just disseminated them differently. He deployed them differently. Everything slowed down, and yet you never felt like you were going too slowly. And he became the sole occupant of this Monkian universe, really, which he brought other people into. But I think it's almost like Sun Ra. Like, how do you categorize him? It's sort of sci-fi, it's bluesy, it's its own sort of private orbit. And Monk was the same way. He completely transcends labels, and yet he influences so many different genres simultaneously.
I know the late Dave Van Ronk, who was a friend of mine, used said to me, you know, it was when he heard Charlie Parker, the same reaction you did. There was so much going on, he wasn't sure what was happening. He sort of liked Ben Webster better. He says, then I started listening to Monk and realizing you can have a lot of things happening as long as you leave some spaces for people to think. And that's what I always felt about Monk's music.
And Monk, he played at Minton's, like in 1941, After Hours joint, where Charlie Christian is playing his pivotal role in inventing bebop. And I think Charlie Christian was a pretty Monkian guy himself. He was fast, but he wasn't like Charlie Parker fast on the guitar. And that sort of dovetails nicely with what Monk was doing. So you have this smoky room, if you can imagine that, and all of these people cross-pollinating these different attributes and styles. And Monk remained his own man, which I find like fascinating because everyone got caught up in the speed game and Monk didn't. And I think some of that speaks to what an individual he was, and maybe he only had it within him to write the 70 songs, because let's put it this way. You can have 70 songs, and they can really be like 70,000 songs. There's all different kinds of ways to quantify these sorts of numbers. It's like a book. I mean, Great Gatsby is 47,000 words long, but it might as well be 800,000 words long for everything it imparts. And when I hear Monk, I'm still constantly unpacking things that he was doing in 3 minutes and 23 seconds, and it never feels like 3 minutes and 23 seconds.
Well, yeah, that was the other thing. I was just getting ready to ask you that question. A lot of his songs, when they're recorded, they're not 7, 8, 9 minutes long. They're not. There's not a whole lot of extra soloing and riffing and all that. He keeps the melody intact throughout. And it seemed that he did when he recorded. Do you think he consciously had his sidemen or the other players with him conscious of that all the time? Don't forget the song. Don't forget the melody.
I think so. It's like Edgar Allan Poe said that, hey, if you can't experience it in one sitting, it's really not worth doing.
Yeah.
That's a little fatuous, but that's, I guess, what you would say if everything you wrote was a short story. But I think Monk, they're almost like these preternatural singles, really. They're like 45s, more so than like long-playing sort of epic tracks. And I would bet his bandmates were well spent trying to keep up with this guy, trying to work through the changes. When he did that, there was the recording ban during World War II, and then like bebop was unleashed after it. And yet Monk really didn't kind of start doing his thing until 1947. And that was his kind of big breakthrough session. Breakthrough, not commercially, but I think artistically. But like swing and blues, jump jive was going at the time. And I think that permeated his thinking, too, that, like, this isn't just supposed to be these long cuts. I don't want to say jukebox-friendly, but he always was kind of, like, amenable to that sort of notion.
Well, I think that it's great that someone is keeping him in the forefront of people's minds. I saw that documentary a few years back where his son played a role, and I think Monk is just such a fascinating American character. You know, I mean, he really seems to me to be, I don't know how to say, as American can be. He's an original. He only could have come from where he came from. And that whole New York sensibility of I'm just going to go out and play what I want to play and do what I want to do and sort of survive, not in an arrogant way, but in a very creative way.
I don't think it hurt him that he had his cabaret card revoked.
Yeah.
It basically meant that he couldn't perform live for quite a time in New York City. You think, like, what could be worse for a jazz musician back then, right?
Because right.
Unlike now, this was your full-time gig, or it could be. This could be your day job, so to speak, even though you're playing at night. And I think it kind of made him write the way he did, concentrate on writing. A lot of times, composers in jazz, they rewrite the same song. They just give it a different name. They put in some different solos. They have a few different chord changes. Monk didn't really do that. So that's another way of looking at his 70-plus songs. They are awfully disparate, one from the other. And I think part of that was because he had to write. He couldn't gig. He could gig out of town. But what happens when you gig out of town? You're on the road. What else are you going to do? You're going to write.
Yeah, as I said, Ellington wrote on the train, in his car, or whatever, because he was always moving. Well, Colin, this has been great. I'm so glad we got to talk about this. It's been a privilege for me to talk to you, and thank you so much for becoming one of our downtown regulars.
Yeah, thanks for having me.